We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by number one New York Times bestselling author Brad Thor, whose latest novel, Rising Tiger, a thriller, will be released on July 5th. Brad, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, Emily, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Now, this is another book in the Scott Harvath series, and this one's set in India. Can you just tell us a little bit about the book, maybe tease it for folks who are thinking about picking it up?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and it's fun because, so I do thrillers. So I want you to take the book to the beach, to the lake, sit and have a great thrill ride. But I call what I do faction, where you don't know where the facts end and the fiction begins. And in real life, 2 years ago, Chinese troops crept through the Himalayas into India, into this disputed border area where no firearms are allowed. And it was like something out of Walking Dead. The Chinese soldiers had made their own homemade weapons, like iron rods studded with spikes, baseball bats wrapped with barbed wire. And they attacked a contingent of Indian soldiers. And it was like so horrific, 6 hour hand-to-hand combat. They needed DNA testing to identify a lot of the bodies of the Indian soldiers afterwards. And I thought, gosh, this is just barbaric. And what's going on in that part of the world? And that kind of clicked with something else in my head. During COVID, during the lockdowns, it really came like home hardcore for me, how much we rely on China for the supply chain and that we manufacture way too much stuff in China. So as China's been flexing its muscles, and again, this is a thriller, it's fiction, it's a spy novel, but in real life, as China's been flexing its muscles and trying to gain influence around the world with the Belt and Road Initiative or signing up basing agreements for its Navy throughout the Indian Ocean with what's called the String of Pearls strategy, I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to set a thriller in India where America is trying to draw India closer. They make great sense. They're a natural ally for us because we're the oldest democracy, but India is the biggest in the world. So I thought, what if we were manufacturing there? What if we had a better military alliance and intelligence sharing alliance with India? And I said, if we tried to create the Asian version of NATO, China would go ballistic. They'd go crazy and they would do everything they could to stop it. And I said, okay, boom. That's what Rising Tiger is going to be about. India in real life is a hotbed of espionage. And I looked around. None of my contemporaries had set a spy thriller there. And I said, that's what I'm going to do. And that's kind of the real life basis for Rising Tiger. And the neat thing is that Robert O'Brien, the previous national security advisor under Donald Trump, has been a dear friend of mine since college.
And so, no way.
Yeah. So
since Robert's college. Really
good. Yes. We were neighbors in L.A. When I went to USC, we were neighbors. And during the Rodney King riots, we were up on our rooftop together because we had a health food store on the ground floor, but they were looting and burning businesses. They got like two blocks down from our building. And so the residents were taking shifts kind of watching out. And so Robert and I had a shift together, and that's how we became friends one night during the riots. So when he asked me what I was doing with Rising Tiger, he said, well, let me tell you some stuff, not classified stuff, but some stuff that didn't make it into the news reports. And one of the things I thought was so cool, Emily, is so the Indian soldiers were incredibly valiant, so courageous, and stood up to the Chinese. And when Robert and his team reached out to his counterparts in New Delhi, they said, we're afraid with winter coming that the Chinese will come back into this area when we're not there and try to take it back, try to keep it. And Robert said, what do you need to stay? And they said, we don't have winterized tents. We don't have cold weather sleeping bags. Robert said, we're going to take care of all of it. And so I found out that the Trump administration helped outfit India with all of this cold weather equipment so that they could stay in this location and China could not come back in and take territory uncontested. And I thought that was really cool.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And Brad, I think your life might be as interesting as Scott's life.
It's my protagonist. Yeah.
Roommates with Robert O'Brien or friends with Robert O'Brien since college. So actually on that note, I wanted to ask, you've taken Scott all over the world, and to be able to dip into a different location and provide the level of granular detail about the environment that you do is incredible. I'm so curious about how your process works in terms of capturing the details, the environment of countries all over the world, countries that, you know, I assume as you set out to write some of these books, the cultures and the environment is it's sort of unfamiliar to you. How do you go about bringing people into that space and that location in a believable way?
That's a great question, particularly for this book, because I knew very little about India. Anyone that I knew that had any connection to India, people I grew up with in Chicago, whatever, were of Indian descent, like maybe their parents, but likely their grandparents had come from India. So there is, you know, it's the melting pot, and they're as American as you and I are. I can trace my roots back to Scandinavian stuff like that, but I'm an American. I speak a little bit of Swedish, no Norwegian. So it was tough. I had to do a lot of research, and I tell people that if I can't go to a location and the Delta variant was just ravaging India when I wanted to go over, and my wife is a doctor, and she's like, I don't know, you know, there's no therapeutics over there. And if you got, you know, hit by a truck and had a really bad, you know, experience, literally, if you got hit by a truck and tried to get into an emergency room, you were going to have a really hard time. And she said, let's say you take all the precautions and try not to catch the Delta variant, and you get a bad case of COVID, you could get a mild one, but if you got a bad one, that's not someplace you want to be trying to get help. So in that situation, Emily, what I like to do, if I can't go to a country, I want to talk to someone who has operated in a country. So this is somebody in the intelligence community, special operations community, someone where their job and very likely their life depends on noticing the details, particularly the really small details. So I have a buddy of mine who is my children's godfather, and he's ex-military, and he's in the State Department now, and he was based at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi. So I was able to get great color stuff from him. I've got another friend who's on Twitter a ton. He's a great guy, ex-diplomatic security service agent named Fred Burton. And Fred he's written great nonfiction, Ghost, about his time in DSS, Beirut Rules, great guy. And I was talking to him and I said, all right, I can take my protagonist, Scott Harvath, who's an ex-SEAL, who's in the intelligence community, America's top spy, and I can put them in different countries where I know how things work. But with this book, we kick it off with that melee. I had to write about that. That's chapter one, the Indian soldiers and the Chinese soldiers fighting it out in the Himalayas. And then chapter two, fast forwards a few months to America has chosen an ex-CIA State Department person who's kind of had a foot in both those worlds to kind of start lobbying India on joining an Asian version of NATO. And he gets assassinated while he's over there. So Harvath, my character, my protagonist, has got to go in and unravel this. And I said to Fred Burton, I said, if there's a police investigation in India going on in a murder, how do I take a guy from the intelligence community, special operations background, and how does he start getting, you know, I don't want him to break into a police station and steal the file or do something dumb like that. And Fred told me about something we have at our embassies, Emily, that I'd never heard of. It's called an FSN/I, Foreign Service National / Investigator. And basically, it's an ex-cop who was pretty well connected and is retired. And then if any American citizens in that country need help with a police issue or somebody at the embassy does, you break out this guy, you get him out from behind his desk, and he can work his old contacts. So I tell people that with this character that's helping Harvath in the book, he's like Sean Connery in The Untouchables, but with an even better sense of humor. And he's an ex-cop from New Delhi that's been behind a desk for 5-10 years and misses being on the street. And he's got a lot of good cop instincts. And I've heard from so many early readers that they just love teaming Harvath up with this guy, and that this guy could actually act as Harvath's guide to Indian culture too. So as I'm trying to explain this, the book happens during the 7 days of a big Indian festival, their biggest one called Diwali. And so it was just fun because I liked the Bond movie that was set against, opens up with the Day of the Dead in Mexico and stuff. So sometimes that's fun to have in the background of a film or a thriller.
Oh yeah, extremely so. I'm sure it's very helpful for readers, like immersing themselves in that location too. Now, this question you've probably gotten it before, but you have been so like you've probably been privy to so many details, behind the scenes information from the intel community, from the military over the years, and what you were just talking about in terms of learning something that was happening at the embassy that people wouldn't necessarily think of or know about. Do you find that truth is stranger than fiction? Because you write faction, and so you incorporate incorporate a lot of this into your book. So as you're doing research, as you're talking to folks behind the scenes, have you encountered things before where you're like, I don't know if I could have even written this?
It does happen a lot. And, you know, I find that the deeper I get into these things, the more thoughtful and considerate, at least on the diplomatic side and the intelligence side, the government works. So you and I as citizens and the people watching and listening to this, we see a lot of the incompetence, right? So we see the long lines of the DMV, the post office screw ups and all this kind of stuff. So when we talk about government, it really is a big, big, big organization. It's like a corporation that has many different business units underneath it. So you can have daily interactions with stuff, whether it's a trash pickup, you know, local police, that kind of stuff, which local police I'm going to leave out because police departments are, I think, far more responsive to local, to citizens. I think that's an area where we actually get really good service for our tax dollars. But there's other things, the DMV and stuff like that, and trying to get your property tax bill fixed, that can be very, very frustrating. But the deeper I get into the intelligence world and the world of diplomacy, the more stuff I see my years in writing these thrillers that I'm really impressed by, the thoughtfulness where it's not only how do we do things differently, but what's worked in the past. So there's kind of this institutional knowledge that gets passed down where I'm a guy that's all for term limits. I don't want people staying in Congress and stuff too long. There's a certain amount of institutional knowledge that does exist in government that I think is valuable, that helps to move people forward, particularly with how diplomacy is carried out and things like that. So when I do these, you do find, I can't believe I've gone, so I've been writing books for 2 decades now, and I've never heard that we hire an ex-cop at, or more than, sometimes more than one at our embassies to help kind of unravel sticky situations with local police for on behalf of American citizens. And it makes sense. Makes sense. You've got, you know, people being arrested for dumb stuff, you know, you get college kids on vacation, like that do something stupid and now they're in jail. So this kind of thing makes sense. And it was cool to fold that into the story. And what I find is the longer I've been at this game, the greatest challenge for me is what to leave out, because I find such cool stuff, but I'm not writing a training manual on how to be a diplomat or a spy. I'm trying to write a thriller. So you want enough of those details to keep it interesting and also to stand out so that people say, wow, I read that new Brad Thor book and I can't believe the stuff that I learned in there.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free price on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that 6-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also the Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those 6-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with 2 bath towels, 2 hand towels, and 2 washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 1-year limited warranty. Those roll and go anywhere MyPillows. You can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bed sheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. That's so interesting. And it makes me think of the new Top Gun doing just like absolute gangbusters at the box office.
Huge.
People have like flocked to it. And I'm curious what you think about the comparison between the movie industry and the novel industry, and how a lot of people are interpreting the success of Top Gun, I think this is probably fair, as an example to Hollywood that there's a market for just patriotic, thrilling, big budget, blowout, military type movies. Did the novel industry, do you think, ever sort of stray away from that? Or has it just been sort of quietly, like with the success of all of your books, understood that there's a huge market for this kind of fiction? And Hollywood, for whatever reason, I think the reason's probably pretty obvious, politics, just sort of got away from it for a little while.
I think you nailed it 100%. I couldn't be happier to see the success of Tom Cruise. I mean, Maverick's over $1 billion worldwide at the box office. The guy's 59 years old. This is the biggest hit in his career. I mean, you think of how far he's come from like Outsiders, and Risky Business was huge. Obviously a big breakout for him. And now he's 59. He's been in this business so long, and he's got a $1 billion hit on his hands. And I'm a big fan of the Mission Impossible movies that he does. So I am a Tom Cruise fan. I really think that Maverick has been successful for a couple of reasons. I think they were smart to delay it, obviously, because they didn't want to deal with people not wanting to go to the theaters during the real kind of thick, tough throes of COVID. But it's bringing people back in that remember the original Top Gun. So you're getting that audience. You're getting a younger audience that had not maybe even seen the first movie that loved this. But there is a deep sense of patriotism and highlighting the American military like that, I think, is terrific. And there is one little side note that dovetails into your thing about Hollywood and novels. So first of all, novels. I think one of the greatest things about the publishers of books is that they realize that there isn't just a monolithic audience for them, that they can actually segment and slice up the pie for whether you like young adult or fantasy or women's fiction, that kind of stuff. So there's multiple audiences and they can cater to them. I think they're much better at cranking that stuff out than Hollywood is, but the budgets are also lower, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to print, you're going to decide, well, this is a new author. She's really good. She's doing something about whatever it is, whatever the topic is. Well, we'll take a chance on her. And what we're going to do is we're going to print this many books. That's a lot different than, you know, you've got a budget for a movie and there's so many people involved with it. But I think the tide politically is turning in Hollywood. And I'll tell you why. I think the success, as you've pointed out, of Maverick is huge. But here's the dovetail part. Sony told the Chinese to go pound sand on the Spider-Man movie. They were not going to airbrush out the Statue of Liberty. So forget it. We'd rather not have the box office. I was so proud of Sony. And also with Top Gun, they went back after a big backlash on social media and put the patches back on Tom Cruise's bomber jacket of Taiwan and Japan. That was really good for Hollywood to say, you know, we don't care. We're going to go ahead with this. We are going to be pro-American. We're not going to kowtow to the Chinese. And in fact, one of the investors in Maverick pulled out Tencent, which is a Chinese company, not because of what was done with the bomber jacket patches, but because they were afraid the movie was going to run afoul of the CCP and really anger the Chinese Communist Party. It's great that Hollywood is saying no to that money, because when you have filmmakers that are trying to get into one of a limited number of slots in China, it means the whole industry is self-censoring because they're creating every single film hoping that they can get into that Chinese market. And that censorship, that is giving China the ultimate veto on our entertainment product. And we are that shining city on a hill. We should be exporting freedom, democracy, all that kind of stuff. You can make a great movie without necessarily beating people over the head with messages and statements. But we should never allow another country to tell us what we can and cannot put in our films. And it shouldn't come down to the box office.
Right. And you can make a great movie without beating people over the head with the idea that America is just irredeemably flawed.
Right.
People don't really want to hear that the country they live in and pay taxes to is irredeemable. And one of the interesting things that came out as a result of the Top Gun controversy is that the Pentagon has been working for years with filmmakers to, like, they'll include training exercises, for instance, in movies, and then they'll exercise a little bit of control over the content, whether or not, I mean, not every filmmaker responds to that, but I'm curious as to, like, and I'll get into this a little bit too. You've actually, like, embedded with Black Ops. You've done a lot of work with people behind the scenes in the military and intelligence community. Do they ever have maybe, like, suggestions or ideas, or, like, they say you really need to get it like this, or do they ever grumble about how it's presented?
It's a great question. So, first of all, one of the best examples of what you just talked about the military getting involved with films, I think, is Act of Valor, that was directed by Miles McCoy, that actually had real SEALs as the actors.
Yes.
And they were moving their film crew based on where the Navy was doing these different training exercises. So whether it was rivercraft stuff or submarine things. And that was probably one of the coolest partnerships I've ever seen between the military. Obviously, Maverick's great stuff too, because you've got the jets and all that. But Act of Valor was always one of my favorites. So with me, when I work with people in the special operations community or in the intelligence community, it is in their individual capacity. Mm-hmm. So it's unofficial. What I do have happen, though, is if they're working with me, I want them to see the manuscript before I send it to the publisher.
Totally.
Because what I've had them say to me in the past, well, Brad, we told you point A and we told you point C, and B's got to come out of the book. I'm like, well, I made B up. You didn't tell me B. And they'll say, B needs to come out of the book. And so I'll take it out. You know, I'm an American first and foremost. I don't want to do anything that could jeopardize sources or methods or put anybody in harm's way. Mm-hmm. And I did have one funny thing happen with somebody where in one of my thrillers, he asked me to rewrite this scene, and I had to do it like 10 times. And on the 10th time of rewriting about this particular item, I said, okay, are we good now? I'm not revealing anything. He goes, oh, no, don't worry about that. He goes, I just wanted to make sure you got it to the point where nobody could trace it back to me, my source.
Yeah.
And he was really funny. He's like, he goes, now it can't be traced back to me, and it's fine. I'm comfortable with that being out there. Nobody's going to figure out the real thing behind this. So I think that's, if you're a journalist, if you're an author that relies on a network of sources, you always want to treat them with respect. You want to be professional, and you never want to poison the well, because you'll never be able to go back to that well again. So I'm always sensitive about that, not only because I so appreciate the people that helped me with my books, because I could not write what I do without the generosity of these brave men and women. But it's just the right thing to do as a citizen of this country, is to respect those men and women that are out there, and not to put them or their colleagues in any sort of jeopardy. But there's no dictating. They don't tell me you have to say this or you have to do that. But it can be very helpful where they're like, okay, I see where you're going here. But if I was in the field,
yes,
and it was 45 minutes from now was my next comms window and I had to set everything up, I would not be on that rooftop. I'd be two blocks down in this parking lot or whatever it is, because nobody would see the antenna I'm going to use, whatever. So it's always very collaborative. I've had nothing but good experiences.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I wonder if you've read other books or maybe even movies that you've seen where you can tell that people haven't done that. Is it noticeable to you when people aren't sort of speaking that language and consulting with that community?
Yeah, you know what? My biggest example that I use is kind of my plug phrase for this is when somebody puts a safety on a Glock. You know, there's no safety on a Glock. And that's that right away is a red flag to me that the author is not, or the filmmakers are not doing their job. In fact, one of the things I hate the most about thriller movies is when somebody's about to engage and they charge their weapon. They put a round in the chamber. If you're a professional, you've already got a round in the chamber. You don't wait till you're just outside the door. And then you rack your slide and you go in. But that's Hollywood. They do that. I'm convinced that the sound effects people get paid by every rack of the slide that's in a movie. So I'll forgive a lot in Hollywood. I'm far less forgiving in a book. My wife will finish any book she's reading. She's that good. I have like a two strikes in the books out policy, because I work so hard to get the details right, and I'm not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But if I make a mistake in my book, A, I own it, and B, it's not because I didn't work my butt off to get that right. You know, so I think that's important. But I'm also, you know, that's my Midwestern upbringing, that I'm very dedicated to my craft and to my readers, who are ultimately my bosses. I don't work for the publisher. I work for the reader. They're the ones that are plunking down $30 for a hardcover or $15 for an ebook or getting the Audible version. So these people, I have to keep happy. And so that's why I want every year to get better as a writer. And then when they leave their review, you know, however many stars they leave, that's my annual performance review. Mm-hmm. You know, I want a 5-star review because I have a career that is very challenging and that I love, but I have it because of the readers. Without them, I don't have the career that I do.
What is your relationship like with your readers? I'm so curious, as somebody who's written more than 20 books in this series over many, many years, I'm sure that you have many readers who have read every single one of them. And it's a very special experience for them when a new book comes out. Can you talk about that relationship?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. For anyone who's watching or listening this to this that hasn't read a Brad Thor book before, one of the things I always want to clarify is my books are like the James Bond movies in that if you've never seen a James Bond movie before, you can go to the theater today and see the latest Bond movie and you're good. You don't need to have watched the one before it or the 10 before it. So while my books have the same protagonists throughout, I write them so that they can stand alone. So if you haven't read one before and you want to start with Rising Tiger, no problem. You're going to be caught up in the action from page one and you're not going to feel like you've missed anything. The readers, it's really special. You and I were talking a little bit before we started recording this, and I told you how I'm really not as present on Twitter as I used to be. I'm actually on Facebook, and there's something like Facebook multiple times a day, and I'm interacting with those readers. There seems to be, you know, we have dialects around the United States, right? People speak differently in Jersey than they do in South Texas and things like that. There seems to be a different, I'm going to say, form of communication, but you're not limited to, you don't have the character limit that you do on Twitter. And it just seems to be, in my view, a little bit more community-based on Facebook. So you're gathering with people that largely are, at least in my experience on my Facebook page, are there because they like the books, we like to read, we're interested in current events. And the dialogue is very respectful. It's really, really nice. And so I've chosen to interact with my fans more on Facebook and to a certain degree on Instagram than Twitter, because I just find it's a better experience, because these are wonderful people and we all have the love of books in common. It's a shared language. And that's one of the neatest things I've found, music and books. You can go anywhere in the world and you can meet somebody. It doesn't matter where they grew up, what they do for a living, what their bank account looks like. If you love music or books, you've got stuff to talk about and it's a shared language. So yeah, I've got people that have been coming to my book signings and stuff since the very beginning.
Wow.
They always want to get a first edition and want to get it signed. And it is like a family. You do get to know. It's like if you had a restaurant and somebody was coming to your restaurant for 20 years, you'd know them, you'd know their grandchildren. And, you know, you'd know what they like to eat. And probably one of the coolest things about that annual performance review or social media is it's like having a suggestion box sitting out in the lobby of your business, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to hear from people as to what they like, what they want to see more of, what they don't like. And one of the coolest things that I've found is that particularly with thriller writers, like Jack Carr, who I'm buddies with, whose latest book is In the Blood, his first book was The Terminal List. Jack is with my editor at Simon & Schuster because a Navy SEAL buddy of mine introduced me to Jack, said, Jack's thinking about writing a book. Would you talk to him on the phone? And I loved him from the minute I started talking to him. I said, when you get the book done, let me know. And he called me back a few months later. He's like, the book's done. What are the next steps? And I'm like, well, let me introduce you to Emily, my editor. He's like, legit, you do? I'm like, you just spent 20 years protecting my freedom and my ability to be an author. Why wouldn't I want to take 20 minutes and try to get you hooked up and plugged into Simon & Schuster? I said, you got to make it on your own. They won't take you if they don't like your manuscript. I said, so all I do is open the door. You get to go in, you know, and then it's up to you. And I couldn't be happier because as of people hearing this, Friday night, July 1st was the debut of Jack's series, The Terminal List, with Chris Pratt on Amazon. And another buddy of mine, Mark Greaney, has got The Gray Man coming out in theaters on the 15th of July, and it'll be on Netflix on the 22nd. And he's a great thriller writer. He lives other side of the state in Tennessee from me. So on social media, what I'm finding is we can all talk about books. I can go on and talk about authors that I can't wait for their books to come out, and authors who I love. And it isn't competitive. That's what I've seen in my business is there's 365 days in a year. You can read a lot of books during that time. So if Jack Carr's got a book out, or Mark Greaney's got a book out, or whatever, Kyle Mills, been a good friend of mine. He's writing the Vince Flynn series, the Mitch Rapp books. And I've known Kyle since before I was ever an author even. It's just a neat business where you don't see other people in your business as competitors. You know, it's a compliment. If people are reading, that's a good thing. That's that rising tide that lifts all boats. And so I've been talking up the terminal list on Amazon Prime and Gray Man on Netflix, and you got to read their books before you see it. And so it's a neat thing. So I've really enjoyed developing this audience of readers and staying in touch with them over the years. And that was one of the hardest things about COVID in the beginning, was that all these book tours got canceled. And it's funny because I had people like, so what was it back in 2020 when we were all in quarantine, there was no, there were no gatherings indoors and all that kind of stuff. And I had people popping up on social media, posting pictures from book tours past. And that kind of became like a little trendy thing. Me with this person, me with this person. This person brought their kids to the event, and it was very nice.
Cancel culture is coming to your bank, and holding the wrong political views might soon leave you out in the cold. I'm Bill Walton. On the latest episode of The Bill Walton Show, Todd Zwicky, Paul Watkins, and I discuss what is already happening, how the Biden administration is already pursuing this agenda, and what we can do about it. This progressive culture offensive is relentless. It's coming for you, and you won't hear about this anywhere else. Follow The Bill Walton Show at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, all those examples of other authors reminds me, there really has been this explosion of ex-SEALs sort of pursuing this type of fictional rendering, or even like their real stories. And mm-hmm. You've been writing about Scott, for instance, for a really long time. I'm curious what you think it is about the ex-SEAL that is so compelling to audiences. What is it something with their personality, their experiences? Because it does seem to be very much a type, you know, if you're a SEAL, you're a certain type of person.
Yeah, it's funny. I was at a dinner years ago at SHOT Show in Vegas, and it was all ex-military guys. And so really, I mean, everybody was there. I think the only thing we didn't have was a PJ from the Air Force. So it was, you know, Force Recon Marines, ex-Delta, ex-guys out of the units, Rangers, SF guys, and SEALs. And it was so funny because the SEAL guys were like really fun, bottle service and crazy. And the Marine Force Recon guy next to me leans over and he goes, Brad, watch, we're going to get thrown out of every single bar tonight in Vegas, and it will be the fault of one of these SEALs at the dinner table. And I'm like, that's not fair. And as soon as we get to Coyote Ugly, there, you know, one of the guys is trying to climb up on the bar and dance. And it was very funny. So one of the most interesting things that I've ever heard to kind of describe the difference between special operations, kind of pointy end of the spear on the Navy side versus maybe like Army side, like SEAL teams versus Green Berets or SEAL Team 6 and Delta Force. Those are really at the top. But what was said to me was the Army is grabbing someone who's been in the Army a lot longer. And that kind of chain, that track, if you will, of getting to a certain point, they're dealing with somebody versus, okay, here's somebody who's 18 and we're going to grab them and move them into this position. And I think it's like anything else in life. So yeah, there's an age difference. So there's a certain amount of life experience, but that's not to say that a SEAL team guy is any less deadly, serious, wise, and tough as hell than somebody who's in 5th Special Forces Group or something like that. It's different. And I think I think the Hollywood mystique probably plays in to our interpretation of, you know, you had the Navy SEAL movie that was with, the guy from Terminator and Charlie Sheen. Yeah, he was in Terminator, I think. So that was so long ago. I think it was like the late 80s. This, you know, Navy SEALs, we're here to get you out, was the joke that like all my Army friends make tons of fun of the SEALs for that. But they're different cultures. Guys are getting into these programs at different points in their career. So there's plenty of heroism on both sides. So you've got to wonder, and I think it's a great question, how is it that the SEALs seem to almost be overrepresented in Hollywood versus, like, you know, Chuck Norris did some Delta Force stuff. It really is interesting. So I'm friends with Marcus Luttrell. So Marcus's book was Lone Survivor and everything. Mark Wahlberg did the movie and that kind of thing. And Marcus and his brother Morgan, who's running for Congress down in Texas, they're twin brothers, two of the nicest, smartest, most laid back, like very cool, very chill guys you've ever met in your life. And that's, you know, it's a good question. Maybe some point I'll have to ask them. And next time you and I do one of these together, I'll say, oh, you know, I pinged my SEAL buddies and said, why are you guys, you know, kind of almost overrepresented in Hollywood? I chose it as an author because my cousins grew up on Coronado, which is where they train the SEALs. So I got to see that stuff growing up. And this ability to handle what, my children's godfather, the former 5th Special Forces Group guy, gave me a lot of grief when I did my first novel because he's like, SEALs don't speak another language. They don't get any language training. We do. And he would say there's nothing more threatening to a SEAL than a Green Beret that has combat diver certification, goes down to Key West and gets his certification and stuff. So it's funny because there's some good natured rivalry in there, but there's been an explosion, not only of SEALs, but there's been guys out of Delta Force and things like that are coming out. Brad Taylor's one guy, Dalton Fury was another guy, and Dalton passed sadly a couple years ago. But there has been an overall, you've noticed veterans that are coming into the fiction space and they're writing and all that kind of stuff. And again, there's 365 days in a year. I think it's fantastic. And my big joke, particularly with Jack Carr, was Jack's mom was a librarian and he'd always wanted to be an author. And I said, when I first talked to him, I said, well, you're smarter than I am. And he said, what do you mean? So you don't even know me. And I said, well, I also wanted to be an author and a Navy SEAL, except you did it in the right order. You were a Navy SEAL, now you're an author. I said, I've been an author and I've now aged out. There's no way I can't go and be a Navy SEAL now. I said, so you're smarter.
That's so funny. Well, if folks are listening, they can't see this, but we always keep a portrait of the dog that was involved in the Bin Laden raid.
Cairo, is that who that is? Is that Cairo?
That's who it is. It's
with Cairo. The titanium teeth.
That's him.
So we had it. Yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, we had it made.
it's a great, I actually have the same dog and she's off camera right now. Athena, push. I'm going to see if I can get her to, come here. Let's see if I can tip this down, if you can see her. I don't
know. Wow, she is beautiful. So she was just chilling off camera.
Yeah.
So wow. Oh, she is beautiful.
Yeah, so that's my fur missile, my Belgian Malinois. And she's a great, great dog.
Oh, man. Yeah, she's absolutely beautiful and very well behaved to sit through podcasts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's just right at my feet and I can trust her and she's going to be quiet. She's not going to bark at anything unless somebody comes unannounced through the door. That's about the only thing. And then you won't even hear her. You'll just hear her taking off.
Yeah,
launching.
Just zooming through the air. That's so funny.
Well, she's comfortable with you, Emily. She's now walking around and playing with her toy. She's good. So
she's
sorry, but I love
time.
Pyro.
Oh, yeah.
I think that I was wondering if that was your dog or what that was. But yeah, it's such a cool story about that dog. And there was another dog that they used when they went after. Was it Zawahiri? Who was it that they went after? And I remember they sent the dog in and they were able to get the dog back out. The guy detonated with a suicide vest. I think it was Syria. I remember President Trump talking about the dog going in after him.
That's right. The dog came to the White House, too. I remember that.
Yes, the dog came to the White House, too. Yeah. And I'm it's terrible. I'm blanking on the dog's name. I remember Cairo, but I forget that other dog.
Well, speaking of Syria, I was reading a critique of Tom Clancy in Jacobin, the socialist magazine, the other day, mm-hmm. and propaganda for American imperialism, which I'm sure you've gotten that many times, or maybe not many times, but a couple of times.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
American right, exactly. Sure. Right. And I mean, you've actually been, you were in, what was it, 2008, you embedded with Black Ops in Afghanistan, you've been in these places, you've talked to these people, and what's the sort of perspective that you can bring to that conversation, having spent a lot of time thinking about this, learning about this, what it means to have the American military, you know, promoting freedom in different parts of the world, even at a time when the right is sort of becoming critical of America's footprint all around?
Yeah, it kind of the isolationist nationalistic turn that we've taken has been very, very interesting. There's been a lot of forces involved with that. It is tough because we have the world is a savage place. I mean, just look what Putin's doing in Ukraine. I mean, I was stunned that he would risk the ruin of his country to go in there and do that unprovoked. I mean, this garbage about they were denazifying Ukraine and stuff is just absolutely ridiculous. And it's been, it's come at a very high cost to the Russians. In fact, as you and I are recording this, it was just announced this morning that the Russians evacuated Snake Island, which is where the Ukrainian soldiers told the Russian warship to go F itself. So it's kind of cool that Ukraine has got that island back. But listen, I am not a fan of nation building per se, because I don't think you can offer people democracy on a silver platter. It's one thing to support a noble, courageous force that's fighting for its own freedom. But if they're not, to go in and impose freedom on a society, I think is a very sticky situation. So mm-hmm. I was pro going, and this is the problem we have is mission creep. It really is it is an issue. So you look at, we wanted to go in and degrade and hopefully decapitate Al-Qaeda when we went in post 9/11. And that was the first time Article 5 in the NATO treaty was ever enacted. And it was the United States asking our NATO partners to help us. That we had come under attack. So what bugs me the most about this from a freedom perspective, because that's the only way I am supportive of the United States getting involved in a foreign conflict, is if we are on the side of good and of freedom. Like, I think we're doing that in Ukraine with the weapons and the aid that we're providing the Ukrainians. But what drove me crazy about Iraq and Afghanistan, there's one thing in particular, and that was helping them create a new constitution and then basing it on Sharia law. So to base the constitution in Afghanistan and Iraq on Sharia law automatically is exclusionary to anyone who wants to leave the Islamic faith, is not of that faith. And I thought, oh my gosh, you know, we keep being told by the government that this is about democracy, it's about freedom. Mm-hmm. And yet you are basing it on Islamic law, Sharia law. So I'm like, that's not synonymous with freedom in my book from my years of studying and what I've watched happen. So it is a tough thing. I know people don't want the United States to be the world's policeman, but there needs to be a policeman. I'm sorry. It's just the way it goes. We can't allow savages like Putin to invade his neighbors for no reason and to try to crush Ukraine because he doesn't like democracy on his doorstep. And that's also, by the way, what I was fascinated by with China in writing Rising Tiger, this summer's book, was that India serves the same kind of burr under the saddle annoyance and fear causing to China that Ukraine does for Russia. The idea that so much democracy is right on the doorstep of a totalitarian state is very unsettling for them, and they don't want that. And after that thing, this is, my kids don't have TikTok. Okay.
I was going to ask you about TikTok. Okay, great. Let's do it.
Let's do it. So no TikTok. And this is very timely because last night the FCC came out with a statement telling the app stores they wanted to pull TikTok. They want TikTok out of the Apple Store, Google. They don't want Americans to be able to download TikTok because they did a whole thing and found that TikTok was harvesting all this information. I mean, it's a spying app is what it is. And it's a Chinese spying app. That's why I never allowed my kids to have it. But what was fascinating when I was doing the research for Rising Tiger, in the aftermath of that attack in the Himalayas, the government in New Delhi said, every Chinese app out of our app stores in India, no more. And it was just such a blow to the Chinese tech sector. And the Indian government said, listen, you have been stealing our personal data and you have been taking biometric data on Indian citizens for years. And it's just not going to happen anymore. It's gone. It's just, your stuff is used for spying. It is, you know, there are these fun apps, but that's just the patina on them. It really, your apps exist for one reason only, and that's to spy on our citizens. So I thought that was really cool that India chucked them all out. And India is a massive market. By 2026, there'll be 1 billion smartphone users in India. So to lose out on that market is a big, big blow for the Chinese.
That's so interesting. And the reason I was going to ask you about TikTok is because during the pandemic, TikTok absolutely exploded with everyone, of course, especially with children. And it seems to me TikTok is one of those social media platforms, I think Twitter probably as well, and Instagram, that is harming our attention spans. It's hard to study, but there are studies that show that's the case, especially with developing brains. And yeah. I definitely wanted to ask you if you are worried about younger people, both as readers and as writers, because you have to sort of have an attention span. Has it been more difficult for you as technology, social media technology has advanced, to sort of find your writing space, or were you... You're always able to sort of get in that headspace, but do you worry about younger people?
Yeah, I do. So I've got two things here. One is the younger people aspect of social media, and then there's a national security aspect of it. Right. So I'll do the young people first. Particularly young women, we've seen how devastating social media can be for their self-worth, their self-respect. So, and the beauty standards that young women will hold themselves to when they're seeing stuff on social media that's not even true, where these women have filtered themselves or edited the photos, and you have young girls thinking that that's where I have to be, I have to look like that. It's like, well, that's not even real. That's just all filters and editing and stuff like that. So that is a problem. B, I worry about attention spans, right? Particularly as an author, because it takes a lot of self-discipline and it takes an attention span to read a whole book. Yet some of the greatest pools of readers are young people, which is still good. So they'll burn through all the Harry Potter books or whatever it may be, Percy Jackson, all these great, great books. But what's interesting, so my kids used to be massive readers. So all through grade school, massive readers. And then high school comes along and it's social media and this kind of stuff. And it's less reading books and more of this stuff. So I do worry about the overall health of our young people and what they're going to grow up and be like on being exposed to these apps. Now, with that said, people are always fatalistic about the generation that's coming up behind them. The World War II generation was called the world's greatest generation. Well, guess what? That's not what they called them before World War II. Yes. They thought socially, they thought they were coddled, that their parents just were too soft on them and all this kind of stuff. That was a generation that was like, I remember a long time ago, we had these stupid baby on board stickers, things that people put in the windows of their cars. Like, don't get in an accident with me. I have a baby on board. And it was kind of this when they were beginning to talk about helicopter parents and all this kind of stuff. And so I remember reading an article at that time that said, all right, all this, what we perceive as weakness in the parenting skills and raising of this generation, it's very much akin to the World War II group. And so yeah, you'll find that generations will surprise you, that when their moment comes in history and they're asked to stand up, they do stand up. There's a lot of stuff that we don't pay attention to. We're upset about the apps, but there's a lot of good patriotism and civic responsibility that gets imbued in our young people every day that you're just not noticing. You notice the bad stuff, but the good stuff is there and it's very powerful. So that's one. The national security issue on social media, I tell people, is our biggest national security risk, because most adults, the majority of adults, are getting their news from social media, not by going out and pursuing different channels or avenues, if you will, of news and trying to figure out what the real story is. So my biggest concern is people that get their news on Facebook. So I know people that go to Facebook pages, and it is a very dangerous place to get your information because your guard is down. Because if you join a Facebook page, you're there because you like the way the other people think. They think like you do. Nobody's challenging your viewpoints or your opinions. So you're more susceptible to be fooled on a Facebook page than anywhere else, because you learn to believe the stuff that you see there. And those Facebook pages are one of the first places that foreign intelligence agencies that want to create problems in the United States go to. Russians, Iranians, North Koreans, Chinese, they love getting into Facebook pages. I remember in Twitter and things like that, there was a big Russian account. I live in Nashville. And there was a big Russian troll account posing as Tennessee GOP forever. And when Twitter finally cracked down, that was one of the ones where people looked around and went, oh my God, those were Russians? I actually thought these were, and I live in Nashville, and I remember watching this account, and I interacted with it a couple of times. I'm like, there's just something not right here. And it turned out to be a Russian account. But a lot of people who I know that are really smart were fooled. So that's the problem with social media, is that we let our guard down. And I also don't think we're as responsible as we should be as stewards of our republic on social media. It's really easy to allow your worst nature to come out on social media. You'd say things there that you wouldn't say over the fence to your neighbor or to somebody at the grocery store and things like that. So I think social media is very corrosive. It was supposed to democratize everything. And yet I think we're more fractured, more tribal now than we've ever been in the past. And it's sad because large chunks of this country have convinced themselves that the people on the other side are the enemy, which is ridiculous. We've got more that unites us as Americans than divides us. But there are people that profit from dividing us. And the politicians, they drive people to the polls by getting them angry and stuff like that. So unfortunately, we're living in what I call an anger economy right now, where people have figured out how to monetize anger and discontent and to convince people that anything that's going wrong in your life is not your fault. It's the fault of this other guy. And the only way your life is going to get better is by making this guy feel pain. And that, I can't think of anything more contrary to who we are as Americans. And I just hope that it doesn't take another 9/11 to draw us all back together. I really hope that that's not the case.
That's very poignant. And you've been writing fiction for a really long time. I don't write fiction. I just write the articles. But I do find that when you have the option to look at Twitter, or the option to look at Instagram or Facebook, it's kind of difficult to get in the headspace where you can sit for a couple of hours and write. Do you have the same
Wi-Fi.
Unplug the Wi-Fi.
I have to unplug the Wi-Fi. Then the other thing that I figured out to do, because that doesn't impact my phone, and I don't have Twitter on my phone. The one thing I have on is Instagram. And so what I'll do is I'll spoof the algorithm on Instagram. So what I do is I go in and watch like 15 or 20 dog videos or baby videos. And so that's all that gets served into my feed, and I could just let it go. You know what I mean? It's like, all right, I've seen enough cute videos of like puppies and babies for the day. It's not a distraction anymore. But yes, I'm guilty of that. And because writers by nature, I think, Emily, are procrastinators to a certain degree, whether it's a 500 words you have to do or, 5,000. I joke that when I'm under deadline, I have the cleanest garage, the cleanest closet, and the cleanest office. Yeah. It's all these other things become more important. So yes, it does make it difficult. In fact, I had my agent recently say, you know, you've been at this for 20 years, and I know it's stressful because you're not an outliner, Brad, you're a pantser. You come in and you sit down and you write what you're going to write. You don't know until you're in front of the computer. She said, would you ever want to, you know, maybe do a book every 18 months. And I said, you know, all I'm going to do is goof off with the extra 6 months. It's not going to make my life easier. It isn't until I feel the weight of that, you know, that deadline crushing me, that I'm finally going to be able to kind of have that exclusion zone where I shut everything out. So, but you're right on the money. Yes, social media is very distracting, even for somebody like me who manages to get a book out a year. It doesn't make it easier.
No, that's amazing. Can you tell us about your experience with the Red Cell program that you've worked with through the Department of Homeland Security? I was so curious to ask you about that one, because it seems like it was a fascinating opportunity.
It was really cool. So I was in the mountains of Utah. This was like a scene out of a movie. I was someplace, I was walking my dog on the trails in the mountains, a place where my cell phone never works. And my cell phone rang. And I was like, whoa, this is weird. And I got invited to join something called the Analytic Red Cell Unit in DC. So in the aftermath of 9/11, before the 9/11 Commission was ever stood up and before they came out with their report saying that 9/11 had been successful because of a failure of imagination on our part as America, they wanted to bring in non-intelligence community, non-military people to help them, creative thinkers, if you will, from outside the Beltway to help them war game targets, scenarios, all that kind of stuff. So I got asked to join Michael Bay, the Transformers, the Benghazi movie director was part of this, Brad Meltzer, buddy of mine, who's a great author. And so they brought us in and paired us up with different people in different groups to work on things that might happen at home, things might happen abroad. And I tell people that it's the Las Vegas of government programs, because what happens in the red cell stays in the red cell. They told me, they said, anything you develop in here with us, you can't put in your thrillers. And I was like, okay, cool. You know, my dad is a no longer active Marine. So to be asked to serve my country in any capacity is an honor. But to do it by using the gray matter between my ears versus picking up a rifle, you know, why wouldn't I do that? And the one thing I can say is, or an interesting part of it, is one of the scenarios that I helped develop in the Red Cell was an attack scenario, and it happened halfway around the world. And so I reached out to my person at Red Cell and I said, this is all over the news. And I said, Fox is calling me, asking me if I want to come on and talk about it, because I used to do a lot of terrorism stuff on Fox. And my person said, you can go on and talk about it, but you can't tell them that we talked about it in Red Cell. I'm like, but it's already happened. He goes, we don't talk about it. Even if stuff happened somewhere in the world and we were looking at it, or maybe starting to work up a plan on how to deal with it, we do not talk about that. In fact, Emily, there's only been one scenario ever published out of Red Cell that I am allowed to talk about, because it was in the newspapers and stuff, is they looked at how terrorists might exploit an arriving hurricane. So when you move people to a shelter, and you've got all these people in one place, great place for potential attack is at a hurricane shelter, and what might happen there, as well as we move a lot of equipment out of the path of the hurricane, bulldozers, fire trucks, you know, ambulances, if possible, school buses to be able to transport people. And we move those to like a marshalling yard outside of what we're hoping will be the path of the hurricane, so that those assets can be brought back in afterwards. And so how might the bad guys take advantage of all that irreplaceable equipment that's going to be so necessary in the aftermath of a tough hit from a hurricane? So that's the only scenario that Red Cell has ever publicly discussed.
Okay, so that's exactly as fascinating as I expected it to be.
It was so, and I will tell you one other thing. It was really cool because one of the guys from the Alphabets in the Soup that was in a group I was in, we had a coffee break, and we went to this room where a little break room, a little table and the coffee and all this kind of stuff. And I was chatting with this guy and he's like, so you're the guy that does thrillers? And I'm like, yeah. And so we were talking just about tradecraft and things like that. And he was telling me about some of the training he had done and blah, 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 blah. And he started like rooting around through the trash. And I go, what are you doing? He goes, well, this would be something I would do if I was like in the field and I need it. Like, let's look through the trash and see what's in here that might be valuable. I'm like, are we looking for intelligence? You know, he said, well, let's just see what we find in there. And he starts putting garbage on the counter in the break room. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he had like an old lighter. He had a rubber glove and blah, 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 blah. He goes, I'm going to build an IED. And I'm like, are you serious? He goes,
MacGyver.
Yeah, he was going to MacGyver up a bomb. He goes, I could take the remaining butane in this lighter and fill the rubber glove, hold it. And he goes, I'm going to show you how with my cell phone, I can actually rig a fuse and attach it to the cell phone so that if anybody calls the site, he's like, we're not going to build this here. We're not going to set it off, but I could set this up. And he goes, that's the kind of stuff that I teach people. And, you know, it was a fascinating time and such an honor for me to be able to do it. You know, like these guys are like, well, send you a ticket. I'm like, I'll pay for my own plane ticket. This is going to be me. I'll come to you. Don't worry about anything. I'll stay for as long as you need. I'll come back whenever you want. And then that spilled over. I got asked to do it for the Pentagon as well. So there was another Red Cell program that was set up and I got invited to do that, which was very nice too.
That's incredible. And it's a good segue into the question that I want to end on, because I'm hoping you have a more optimistic take than I do, which is, again, you've been to Afghanistan. I think we're coming up on the year anniversary of our retreat from Afghanistan and the end of that war. And that sort of seared into a lot of people's minds, I imagine, some disturbing scenes, some disturbing footage from media, and in a way that might have made people doubt the preparation of the military or the high standards that our military should have. There was that famous exchange with General Milley last year in Congress where he was talking about white rage. And since then, there have been all kinds of discussions about whether our military, if you look at what the Chinese Navy is doing, if you look at what's happening around Taiwan, if you look at our military preparation, there are people who are genuinely concerned that it's fallen, that it's slipped. And Brad, maybe your take isn't as optimistic as I'm hoping. But what is it? What is your perspective on the as someone who's followed this for a very long time, followed our military through the 9/11 era, before it, after it? What level of preparation does our military have? Has it slipped at all?
So I think we have. we've got issues. I've been particularly concerned about the Navy. I don't think we have enough ships. And I think we really need to up what we're doing ship-wise. When we look at China's trying to get its nose in the tent in the Arctic, and they're actually building icebreakers. China is building icebreakers. And we only had one functioning icebreaker. And so under the Trump administration, they had leased a couple of icebreakers from foreign countries that they could do a big orange, blaze orange U.S. Coast Guard color on there, put some 50 cal machine guns on there, put a skiff on there so that they could deal with sensitive information. And so we've got, as far as our surface fleet and that kind of stuff, we've got ground we need to catch up on with the Navy. There was just a big article about the condition of several of our ships and China and the way China's building up. So China is a threat that we're aware of and that we need to keep countering. And we need to, you know, they're going to quickly go from being kind of a near peer to being an equal. That's not going to take a lot of time. And the Chinese are much more forward thinking, I think, than we are. We think in election cycles and they're thinking in centuries, you know. So as far as the military is concerned, we have an all-volunteer force. We have incredible men and women that, you know, that sign that check, that blank check that says up to and including my life. So we have amazing men and women that serve this nation and help. I always tell people there is no American dream without those willing to protect it. So we don't have a personnel problem. I see us as having kind of an equipment and materiel problem. That's where we really need to up our game. I mean, we spend a ton on stuff, but we need to keep investing. We need to be able to handle a two-front war. And I don't know that we're able to do that right now, particularly with the condition that the Navy's in. And the Navy's not terrible. Navy's not terrible, but it's not as good as it should be. So I'm optimistic in that sense. We have a fabulous Navy, but we've got too many people with excellent command experience that aren't signing back up. We just last week, they just let six people, the Navy just chucked six people out. That was like this mysterious news thing last week where they dropped six people. I forget what their ranks were, but I mean, these are relatively experienced senior people that got let go from the Navy, and there was no explanation why. So there's that, we're back to that institutional knowledge, right? Mm. So that's important to keep. In fact, the Washington Post had a great article on the admirals like Nimitz and these other people that helped us win World War II. They would be thrown out of today's Navy. So if you had a drunk driving, if you had, you know, you cheated on your wife, all things that are inexcusable, right? So drunk driving is not good. Cheating on your partner, your spouse is not good. I'm not saying, but these were flawed men that helped us win World War II, and they would not be retained under the standards of today's Navy. So I'm being a little bit tough on the Navy, but it's an easy target. But I think we're learning a lot too about our adversaries, particularly Russia. You look at Ukraine and how with the Javelin missiles, they've just been, and now the Harris, Ukraine has really proven the efficacy of not only our technology and equipment, but also what a paper tiger the Russians are. So that's going to be interesting. And I'm wondering what we'll see going forward as far as a pivot. And you're seeing it in Madrid this week with NATO discussing, okay, Russia's the greatest threat to Europe. But hey, we also, this is NATO, we need to keep an eye on China. So I think you'll see us starting to talk more about the Chinese and less about Russia. And I think we'll see a little bit more of a sorting out to that's really where we need to kind of be focusing on how and where and why are we building up the Navy in particular, because the Chinese have never expected to win a conventional war with us. In fact, there's a great white paper that two of their colonels did called Unrestricted Warfare many years ago, and it got published. Somebody translated it into English, and I have a copy here in my office. And the Chinese realized, never going to beat America on the conventional battlefield. So what we need to do is figure out how do we weaponize things that the Americans take for granted, the power grid, the internet. How do we bring America to its knees without ever fielding somebody, a PLA soldier on American soil? How do we beat them before ever meeting them on the battlefield? So China's really something that the U.S. needs to be focused on. And I know we are. I know that just from friends in the past administration, the current administration, nobody's taking their eye off the ball on China. But we need to have the national will. And when you have an isolationist kind of movement coursing through the bloodstream, it makes it difficult. Politicians have to be even more adept at making the argument on why improving the military and anticipating a threat that's not there yet, but very likely could be in the future, why that's important and why we need to continue to invest in all branches of the military, but particularly with the Navy. So it's going to be a tough sell with politics the way they are now, but it's a sell that needs to be sold.
Well, the book is Rising Tiger. It has a very patriotic, appropriately patriotic release day of July 5th. Brad Thor, this hour is blazed by. You've been so generous with your time. Thank you so much for coming on Federalist Radio Hour.
It's my pleasure, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Of course. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.